theme of Deuteronomy. We're going to spend a bit of time looking at this together. And just by way of introduction, I think when I was looking at it, I don't know what it was. I kind of kept going over it and over it and over it and over it, and I sort of made a certain amount of progress with it, and I'd come to a halt. I'd go back over it and start all over. I'd keep working all the way through it, and I'd kind of come to a halt. And I don't know if it's just tiredness or lack of inspiration or whatever it was. I kept just kind of going over it and over and over it. Eventually, I kind of sat down and had a conversation with Sian. I said, look, Sian, I'm really struggling with this. And it's funny, just having that conversation really helped me to kind of clarify my thinking and get something to bring to you tonight. So I want to give credit to Sian for her help this evening. And strangely, this has often been the case with me, I find that maybe the help comes by looking at something a way that I'm not used to. So I've ended up looking at this passage from the end, starting at the end and then working back through it. So strangely, the end of the passage has been more useful to me to understand the beginning of the passage. And so I'm going to be starting at the end and ending at the beginning. Basically, that's what my outline is for tonight. Because I tell you what I was really puzzling over. Because, I mean, really, each of these sections, I could preach a sermon. I have preached sermons, and, you know, probably more than one sermon on the Passover or on the festivals or the importance of justice. There's so many things in this passage that one could really usefully spend a proper amount of time doing. But what I found I was kind of puzzling over, and I couldn't work out, was what is the connection? What is the connection between everything that he's been saying before in this sermon and then he comes to these sections, and then it runs into justice, and then it goes into these forbidden forms of worship. And it seems almost like a little bit random, as if the connection between these different parts was just a little bit random. And I get the thing about the three feasts, but there is a flow going through here. Observe the month of Abib, keep the Passover. You see there in verse 2, you shall offer the Passover sacrifice. And then verse 9, you shall count the 7 weeks. And then verse 13, you shall keep the Feast of Booths. And then verse 18, you shall appoint judges and officers. Verse 21, you shall not plant any tree. You shall not sacrifice. Verse 17, there's a kind of, you can see there's all those things are connected, aren't there? There's a rhythm to it. So in his mind, there is some sort of there is a connection going through all of these things, and I wanted to understand what that connection was. So there's this kind of harmony about it. The whole passage holds together as if they are connected to each other. But what is the idea? What is Moses really getting across to the people? Yes, he's getting across the absolute detail of all of these things, when the events should happen, when this should be practiced, at what date, when you've got a council to do this, what you're to do when you get into the land, going into the detail. But what's the big picture? What's the big idea here? And I found that my way in actually came from verse 21. At the end there, you shall not plant any tree as an Asherah behind the altar of the Lord your God that you shall make. So, I mean, when I look at that with you, presumably it all becomes completely apparent and clear to you too, right? Well, I looked at it, and I looked at it, and I looked at it, and I looked at it, until suddenly I kind of like could just see a way in. I saw a way in. So I want to share with you a way in. I mean, let me just treat the very end bit, that bit about not sacrificing to the Lord your God or an ox or a sheep, which is a blemish or anything of a defect. I mean, let's just take a very practical thing. It's been Christmas time. People give and receive gifts at Christmas time. I had a relative who would often give me, for example, so I might have given them something several years before as a present, and I would get this thing wrapped and presented back to me several years later. That was one event that happened. This same person also had a want of kind of giving me something that was clearly second or third hand and was not in particularly good condition and not particularly kind of well suited to me. I couldn't really see what this had to do with me exactly, except for they'd quitted themselves and they'd given a present at Christmas, and that was about it. And I think what he's appealing to in all of these sections, in everything that connects it all together, is this general sense of some things are just not acceptable. Just some things you just, you can't swallow. And in the same way as you can say, you know, we're coming to God. We're coming to God. And the idea of kind of presenting God some blemished offering, some imperfect sacrifice, is just, it's a completely unacceptable idea, isn't it? When you think of God and all that he's given us and all that he is and his pristine holiness, the very idea of kind of sticking something together. I'm not talking about, you know, we appreciate when a child, you know, makes something. They're giving you their best, aren't they? And we can see that that's their best. And we appreciate it for those reasons. But a kind of, there you go. It's insulting. It's insulting. And there's something insulting about the idea that anybody should consider bringing anything less than their very, very best to such a God as ours. There's a sense of kind of, it's like this idea has struck his mind. He's preaching to these people. They're going to go into the promised land. He's going to be staying behind. They're going to go to the promised land. And you know when you let people go and you wave them goodbye and they're going off into life and they're going off into the... And your hopes, your highest hopes and dreams for them is that they're going to fulfill their potential and bring credit to... But in the back of your mind, there's always this concern that they could just behave in a completely unacceptable and appalling way. And I think as he's talking to these people, he's talking to probably tens of thousands of people. This is the gathering of the whole nation. And they're going in, and there's so much standing between where they are at that moment, standing there in the wilderness. Promised land's over there. There are battles to be fought. There's giants to kill. There's so many things that somehow, what could happen is they've come so far. God has brought them such a long way. When you think back about what the Lord's done in your life, the years the Lord has been with you, the things he's done for you, that he's brought you to this day, that somehow going forward, we might run out of love or run out of zeal or run out of passion. And at the end, we'll not give him what he deserves. We won't end well. We will present some blemished offering, something unworthy of his name. And I think this is what kind of chimed in with me when you look at the Asherah pole and what he's talking about in verse 21, moving backwards, you know, like the Hebrews, we're going from the wrong side, going reading the other way. And I think it's there too. It's the same idea there. That here is this blemished offerings, this picture of an altar with an Asherah tree growing up next to it. The idea of a courtroom where injustice is being practiced. The idea that these festivals, these feasts that are so crucial to their history and everything they've been through and all that God has done, that all this could get forgotten, could get compromised. They could become sort of bogged down in the world and wearied and lose the brightness and the clarity of who God is and what he's done and the message they have to the whole world as his ambassadors. These poles that are talking about there, the plant a tree as an Asherah beside the altar of the Lord, you shall not set up a pillar. These groves, these sacred groves, these sacred trees being planted next to the very altar of God. You know, these represent the indigenous religion of the Canaanite people. That's what, you know, if you travel through Canaan before the invasion took off, that's what you'd have found. In every high place, you'd have found these pillars, these trees, these groves, these places of worship for Asherah. And he, for a moment, is seeing the possibility that they've come out of Egypt. Abraham was prophesied that they'd be down there 400 years. The power of God came, the miracles. They came through the wilderness. They invade the land. They conquer all the giants. They get up to Jerusalem. They build, and then they plant an Asherah pole by the altar of the living God. That they somehow end up like imbibing the things of the world the purity of the church will be lost. The purity of their doctrine, of their teaching would get lost. And they'd end up with this kind of admixture, this kind of, you know, alloyed religion, a mixture between the Canaanite religions amongst the people who they've been dwelling and the historic faith which they've been entrusted to by God. And it's an appalling idea to him. It's as appalling as the idea of somebody offering a gift, a substandard gift to a great God, this idea that this could end up with these kind of shared faith, this kind of multi-faith nation, if I can put it like that. So that, I think, was my way in. I started to see that he's deeply concerned about where things could end up. And he has this kind of horrible idea that appears before him that he needs to address by speaking to them and to head off that possibility. There are all around the world, there are hybrid faiths. You know, they're kind of a little bit of this and a little bit of that, a bit of the original religion of the place and a little bit of a kind of slight misunderstanding of Christianity or a bit of Islam or a bit of all mixed up together. The world is full of these sort of things. And syncretistic religions, you know, the religions that have the outward form of something, but people only have to go through outward things, and so they show up and they come to the service and they do, but inwardly and under the surface, they really carry on with the old ways, the old practices, the Reformation has not... They've not been changed from the inside. They haven't been purified and sanctified. They've just been kind of whitewashed. And there's a real concern. There's a real concern that could happen to God's people. We could get mired and compromised and bogged down after all they've been through. And surely from the point where he's preaching there, on the other side of the Jordan River, there are battles to fight. There are hardships to endure. They're going to have, and to have gone through so much and end up with so little, that would be a terrible travesty, wouldn't it? What a terrible travesty. It's important to end well, isn't it? How your conversion experience is the time when the Lord first met you. What times they were, right? Bright and clear. The division, the mark, the change. And then you get involved and you press in, and the challenges and the trials and the tests and temptations, the weariness, the repetitiveness, all the things that come to you through your Christian life. And the danger, like a stone, you just, the drip, drip, drip of life just wears away at you, and you get worn down, and you lose your zeal. You lose your love. You lose your real appreciation, the bright clarity about who he is and what he's worthy of. And I think this is what he's, as a pastor, like Moses is pastoring all these people. And he just does not want to see that happen. It'd be a crime, wouldn't it? What a shame to begin our journey into faith and end up with a half-baked religion. You know, the people who, I used to be a Christian. I have a more nuanced view now. My views have kind of become more sophisticated now. I can see that actually all religions are alike. Or, you know, they've lost the glory of it. Do you know what a liger is? Exactly. They breed people who breed tigers with lions. Right? You know, you're not a lion. You're not a tiger. You're a liger. It's good to be a Christian. A Christian. It stands out. It's distinct. And the Asherah, this was a female deity, a female goddess, part of the ancient Near Eastern polytheistic traditional religions. And she was always worshipped with a companion. She was never worshipped alone. There was always Asherah on the one hand and Baal on the other. Okay? Baal was the male, if you can put it like that, and she was the female deity. They were like husband and wife. He was the hero lord thingy of the Canaanites and whatever people group worshipped, and she was his consort, and they went together, Asherah and Baal. And this picture of the Asherah pole growing up to next to the altar of the Lord is almost suggesting, almost proposing that a marriage has taken place. But not Baal, but Yahweh. That they've come into some arrangement, some compromise, some covenant has been made between the two of them. It's true, isn't it? All the way through the Old Testament, there's this concern, isn't it, about the people just ending up mingling, mixing, giving their daughters in marriage, giving their sons in marriage. There's some sort of, in the end, the distinctiveness of the people gets lost. And I think in this moment, this vision, this idea of this pole and this altar together, it's like suddenly they become husband and wife. God forbid. God forbid. No, you shall not. That's the substance of it. You shall not. You shall not, verse 21. That's not how this is going to end up. That's not how this story finishes. And there must be times in Israel's history when they went down the path of idolatry when it looks like that's how the story would finish, doesn't it? But there's something about this word, you shall not, the way Moses speaks to them. On the one hand, he is being prescriptive. He's telling them what they should do and what they shouldn't do. He's giving them orders, commandments. But he's also prophesying to them, you shall not. As if somehow there's a promise. That is not how it's going to be. Because the wonderful thing about being a Christian is that the Lord God himself helps us to persevere, doesn't he? There is a sense in we shall not. Yes, we understand what we're called to do and not to do. But there's also a sense is that he is with us to help us. These things apart. I love those verses that when we shall see him, we shall be like him. Something is going on amongst God's people. He's helping us to fulfill. Not to say that we really going to respond, but we know he's with us to help us and to fulfill these things too. And he's prophesying and telling them at the same time that there's not going to be a marriage like that. There will not be an accommodation like that. And sometimes people, we Christians, we get ourselves into a bind. We get ourselves into a compromising situation. We get ourselves into a fix. Sometimes we could even get to believing that I'm beyond help. I'm too mired in all this. I'm too mixed up now to be separated again, to come back to the Lord and to walk with him properly as I should. It's never too late. If you ask for help, he will help you. He will help you to get free. And to glorify him, and to set a pure altar. No trees, just an altar. You and God, you and the Lord God. A proper sacrifice. There is only one proper sacrifice we can offer. There is only one proper sacrifice. And you know how we should live, right? Jesus. Jesus alone. So, there's this kind of idea that they're kind of like there could be this marriage being good. And like then going back into it, I sort of think, does this idea feed back through into this whole thing about justice? Imagine if you went to court, you had a reasonable claim, and they say, okay, now we're going to hear the evidence, and you've got a claim to make, and the judge will listen to the evidence of one party, but not of the other. Would you accept that? Would you protest? Would you throw your hands and say, this isn't justice? It's completely unacceptable. And I think he's putting these ideas before these things, these ideas are unacceptable. Justice should be a given for everybody, shouldn't it? Yes? Is there a better means than justice? Can you think of a better way than justice? There should be justice. And the idea that somehow you could go to court and not receive justice is an appalling idea. It's an abhorrent idea, isn't it? Growing a pillar by the altar is an appalling idea. Offering a blemished sacrifice is an appalling idea. These are appalling ideas. So let's turn from evil and do what's right. Let's glorify the Lord. Let's glorify the... And he knows there's going to be battles before. And he knows they're going to get tired. He knows they're going to be tempted and tried. He knows the future is not going to be easy. The world's not going to roll over. There's something called Satan is working actively against God's people. The world sits there solidly, looking immovable. The flesh gets weary and tired and sick. Temptation comes our ways. And yes, we submit to it at times. Lord, have mercy. And yet, don't give up the fight. Keep that altar pure. Make sure justice is done. Keep seeking the Lord. Keep seeking the Lord. So, there could be no marriage between Yahweh and Asherah. Can we know an acceptable level of corruption? Is there an acceptable level of corruption? We say, oh, that's okay. A bit of corruption. It's a holy God. There's a call to holiness. And he is exhorting, you shall observe, keep these things, to hold these things precious, to hold them inviolable, because there is no better religion than the truth. There is nothing better. There is nothing better than what we've been given. And going back into it and going to these festivals. So imagine if I started messing around with your history. You know, the big fear these days is identity theft, isn't it? When somebody hijacks your identity and your personhood and your details, and they start using those to do things that you didn't do. And people say, well, you did this and you did that. And say, no, I didn't. That wasn't me. If somebody started telling me where I was born, or who my parents were, or where I went to school, this is my history, this is my identity. And if people, I know I get a bit forgetful sometimes, but broadly, I know. And he's telling them that they've got to get the facts of their history straight and defend them and protect them. The historic faith that we have, you've got to know your history, know who you are, know where we come from. Know what God has done for you in the past. Be absolutely clear and sure about it. He goes down into the depths of the detail, doesn't he? The very evening that the Lord brought you out of Israel. This happened. Our faith is a historic faith based on what God has actually done in the world. And people would soften it down and compromise it and muddy it and confuse it. And with that, you lose the clarity of where you've come from and who you are. It's an appalling idea. It's an appalling idea that you would forget your birthday. We're going to just move your birthday now, Rachel. We're going to forget what God has done for you. Are you going to forget what God has done for you? Are you going to stop? Are you going to turn away from those things? Are you going to forget? But playing with the past. Israel did dwell in the wilderness. It happened. They were slaves in Egypt. It happened. God came in power and delivered them. It happened. They sacrificed that lamb that night, the blood on the door, the angel of death passed over them, Egypt died, they lived. It happened. It's so easy to forget what God has done for you, to forget your past, God's past dealings. And if you forget what he's done for you, your hope for what he will yet do for you will get more and more dim. Because there is nothing more encouraging when you're facing a challenge forward into the future. Well, he did this. Do you know the verse that says, he who has given his one and only son, will he not also give you all things? You look back at what Christ has done for you, and you get faith and hope for what he will yet do for you. So don't forget. Don't let anybody change the dates in your diary. So he's very detailed, isn't he? He goes into all the detail of the things that to remember. So I think my title for this ended up being Our Faith, Nothing Added, Nothing Taken Away. Nothing added, nothing taken away. Keep it simple. Let's stick to the gospel. Let's hold to the gospel. I put a statement from Louis Burkhoff's Systematic Theology, the introduction to Louis Burkhoff's Systematic Theology, up on Facebook. And he describes how he felt it was an important undertaking for him to actually try and set down the historic theological truths that had been entrusted to him so that the church in coming days could use it as a resource. And he was really, really concerned about the errors that were coming into the church, the kind of heresies that were coming into the church, the kind of downgrades that were happening in the life of the church, and the lack of appreciation or value of the great truths contained in Scripture. People were coming superficial, and he was deeply, deeply concerned about that. And somebody underneath that wrote of this church. They said, at NBBC, you get the Bible taught. They'll teach you the Bible. Nothing more, nothing less, no frills. Or something like that. And I was deeply humbled and thankful that somebody felt that they could say that confidently about this church. Nothing added, nothing taken out. I hope it's true. I hope it's true. And would you like to think that every church, everywhere around the world, are just keeping it simple, preaching the truth, preaching the Bible, one altar, one God, the historic faith, and not getting bogged down in the world? And it happens. It happens really, really bad. So, I don't know if you're like me, but I've gone through a few trials to enter the kingdom. And please pray for me. The last thing I want, imagine having started your race to not complete it, to get lost on the way. Wouldn't that be awful? To have come so many years and then give up and end up with some halfway house. Nothing added, nothing taken away. And I wonder if Moses was here tonight, what counsel, what advice he'd be giving us. As you all face your tomorrows, as you go ahead into your week, what kind of, do you think he'd, what would he encourage you to do? I think he'd encourage you to just kind of keep it simple. Keep it pure. Don't get sidetracked. Don't make compromises. Not these kind of compromises. That's the way he shepherded Israel. And I'm sure if he was here tonight, that's the way he would shepherd us. Keep, observe, you shall. And when you think about, just conclusion, when you think about the kind of things that he's talking about defending things like the Passover. He's talking about the Festival of Booths. He's talking about these things. If the Bible tells us that the people of the Old Testament look on us in the New Testament with envy because we have the things that those things were speaking about. We have the substance of it. They have only the shadow. If they were zealous to hang on to the shadow of these things, how much more should we hang on to the substance of it? I'm not going to go on any further. I think our time is done. I think you've understood the message which I'm trying to convey to you. They had a Passover lamb. We have Jesus, our Passover. And we are in the presence of a very great God who has done very great things for us. And what would any of us profit by adding anything? Our ideas, our works. Don't we try to add anything to Christ? Is there something, can we improve on him? Or should we take something away from him? Is there something unseemly, unright, inappropriate that we could withdraw, or take away, or soften down? He's perfect, isn't he? He's perfect. And that all we need is him. All we need is him. God came to ransom captive Israel. He led them through the wilderness. He'll lead us. He'll continue to lead us. Amen. Right. Let's sing something, shall we?